Coming up on today's show...
I'm a big believer in that the worst thing for creative ideas is a bunch of people who agree. Things really get electric when you find people who have a dissenting opinion. And when I can't find one, I go looking for it.
Welcome to another new episode of Now Hear This Entertainment, featuring interviews with guests who are having success in entertainment, primarily music. I am Bruce Wozniak, talking to guests who are singers, songwriters, musicians, recording artists, and more from the worldwide music community. Get in touch with me by writing to podcast@nhte.net, or instead of email, you can DM me through the @NowHearThisEntertainment Instagram account. Joining me today on the Now Hear This Entertainment guest line from Los Angeles, my guest is a singer, songwriter, guitar player who has a new album coming out next week, Friday, September 13th. He has been written about in the likes of People Magazine and American Songwriter, as well as interviewed on MSNBC. His collaboration with Aloe Black earned a Grammy nomination this year, and he has also done a song featuring Dave Koz. The videos on his official YouTube channel have a combined total of more than 2.5 million views, and a single that he released this past February has over 144,000 streams on Spotify. He is a former CEO of Activision and Deutsche LA, where he led record-breaking launches for major franchises like Call of Duty, and was named one of the 50 most creative people in business by Ad Age. You've been hearing a song of his called Day One. Welcome to Now Hear This Entertainment, Eric Hirschberg.
Bruce, it's great to be here. Thank you for that introduction.
You bet. Yeah, a lot of great highlights that I just read off there. I'm excited to talk with you.
One of them, unfortunately, I need to correct you on. Aloe Black has a Grammy nomination. Our project does not, as of yet.
Okay. As of yet, stay tuned.
Yeah.
Let's get started by having you share first all about the song of yours that was just playing during the intro called Day One.
Day One houses the lyric that the entire album is named after, which is Secondhand Smoke. And as that title might indicate, it's about getting the toxic relationships out of your life and kind of how weirdly difficult that is to do. That's really the lyrical topic of that song. And it's an interesting song from a musical standpoint in that the hook, the guitar hook, that melody that repeats throughout the song is one that has been with me literally for years. Mm. I think the first time I wrote it was, I don't know, I might have been in college.
Wow.
And I think I've had numerous shots on goal of putting it into a song. And I think I had a super hard rock version of it at one point that was much faster paced. And that melody has just always kind of haunted me.
Mm.
And it's just come back and back and back, but I've never put it into a song that I liked until I found it in this one.
There's such a thing, though, I'm sure, as trying to force it, and you had to have the discipline at some point of saying, I'll know when it's right to use that guitar hook. I just can't try to keep forcing it because I feel so strongly about this. Yes?
Yes, that's true. And also for me, I don't know if this is true for other songwriters. I think everyone's process, you know, that's the magical thing about songwriting, is it's so personal and everyone has a different way of doing it. For me, the writing process of music is almost completely disconnected from the lyric writing process.
Mm.
I kind of have two different creative tracks going in my mind at all times where every time I pick up a guitar, I'm hunting for hooks and chord progressions and melodies that I like. And I record them and capture them sort of in one section of my brain and of my, you know, voice recordings on my iPhone. And then separately, there are ideas for lyrics or lines that I feel like I could build a song around. And that goes into a notes document. And then at the end, there's sort of this intersection of those two freeways where I kind of try to match make different lyrical directions with different musical directions. And I think that haunting guitar melody was waiting for this topic to emerge in my life. And when they came together, it just felt like they belonged together.
So is Day One a solo write then? It sounds like from what you just described. And for that matter, do you remember when you say, I'm going to say first started into the song, or maybe you're going to tell me that you wrote it basically in a day kind of thing.
No, I've never had that experience. I hear of writers who sit down and it just comes flowing out of them, almost effortlessly, and they refer to themselves with, almost spiritual words like I'm a vessel and the
Yeah.
song is just flowing through me. For me, I wish I had that. I've never experienced that. It's really a sort of craftsmanship grind where I kind of piece it together one block at a time. For me, it usually starts with a spark. Musically, the spark for me on this one was the guitar hook, the first melody you hear. And the lyrical spark was this idea of maybe one day it'll be day one. I just like that turn of a phrase. And that idea was about when you release yourself from a relationship that's hurting you or that's dragging you down or that is in some way no longer workable or productive for you. Again, a very hard thing I find to do emotionally, but when you do, it's freeing like few other things, and it feels like you are suddenly lighter and clearer. And once you kind of create that release for yourself, it does feel to me like a day one, like a new day.
I love that description. I love that. Audience, please make sure you check out Day One in its entirety since I was talking over it during the intro and did not get to play it in its entirety. As I mentioned in the intro, next week, Friday, September 13th, Eric, you have a new album coming out. Go ahead and tell us all about that project, what the title is, how many songs, who you worked with on it, all the details.
Okay. Before I do that, Bruce, I want to share one more detail on day one. Sorry
Yeah.
to go back. But as I was talking, I forgot the fact that I told you that that melody has been with me for a while. I had an entirely mixed, mastered, completed, finished version of this song, note for note, this song that was like a hard rock song.
Whoa.
And I don't know who to compare it to. It sounded like it could be on a Spoon album or almost like a Strokes album. If you can imagine that same hook played faster and harder. Dun, do, 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 do. It had a whole different nature. And it was one of those sonic outliers on the album where when I listened to the nine songs in progression, that song just stuck out like a sore thumb. The rest of the album has a sort of folk rock, Americana, roots rock basis to the production, sound and the instrumentation. And that I liked it, but it really didn't fit.
Yeah.
And also, it felt like it kind of veered into a weird kind of stadium rocker that also didn't fit with the lyrical tonality to me. So just, I loved it, but it didn't feel right. And so I was done with the album. It was all mastered. And I said, we got to redo this song. I don't know if it gets cut from the album or if there's another way to approach it, but it just doesn't fit.
Oh my gosh.
And I worked with my engineer and we just kind of started with that acoustic guitar version and the almost choral, choir backing the ooze that accompany it, and we just built it up from there. So maybe someday I'll release that rocking version as it's sitting there done.
Wow, fascinating story. So go ahead then about the entire project, the nine songs, including Day One, of course.
So it's interesting. It's my second album, full length, and the first album I worked with a producer, an incredible producer named John Alesia, who I'm sure you know has produced the likes of John Mayer and Jason Mraz and, just huge artists kind of in my genre. And he approached it very differently than this album. He kind of called it a live studio album, where most of the production work was about almost casting the other musicians and, finding the right people to bring it to life. And then we rehearsed and rehearsed and we recorded everything with minimal overdubs in a couple of days at the Village Studios. And it was kind of, almost all played live. Of course, we did go back and re-record vocals and some other things. But, and I think you can feel that. I always like those kinds of albums. I think, a lot of my favorite albums, Fleetwood Mac and Tom Petty, they did that approach. This, on the other hand, started during COVID. So, of course, it started with me alone in my home studio, laying down tracks one at a time and layering them. Could not be more different from an approach standpoint, but I find both have their advantages. The advantage of the live studio album approach is you get more moments of spontaneity, you get more moments of surprises. I think you can feel the chemistry in the room. But what I would do with this is I would get some tracks that I was happy with, and then I would send them to trusted, collaborators, Michael Chavez on the guitar, Blair Cinta on the drums. They play on almost every track, I think. And everyone sort of has more time to sit with it and more time to iterate and more time to polish and more time to try different things. And so I found that you got a lot more creative engagement from other musicians using this approach, because they'd get sort of hypnotized by it and they'd get it in their minds, and then they'd wake up the next morning with a different idea on how to approach the guitar or the cello or the bass or whatever, whichever musician was working on it. And then I'd just get these treasure troves of files back. I tried it this way, but I also tried it that way. Tell me what you think. Mm. And so, you know, kind of emotionally, I want to like the live in the room together thing better, because it feels more analog and it feels more human. And I believe a lot of music comes in the interplay between players. But I really did find there were some unique advantages to approaching it one piece at a time. And, you know, they both turned out, you know, in such a way that at least I like them.
Well, and, you know, there is something to be said for, and I've started to become a little repetitive, this is obviously a important topic because it seems to be a recurring theme on this show, which is you let them do what they do. So you can have an idea and you can send them stems and say, here's what we got. And if by golly, they have something that is just going to blow you away, you got to defer to, this is their area of expertise. You're not going to go in there and tell a drummer, hey, you really crushed it, but this is what I had in mind. Please change back to what I,
right.
You know, because now you're stifling his art, you're stifling his creativity. And so I get both sides, like you're saying, but yeah, I like the idea of giving them a chance to listen and then come in and do what they do best.
And lots of times I would get surprised. Like they would take it in a direction that I didn't hear. I'll give you an example. The first song on the album is called Good Morning. And the way I was playing it alone in my room, it sounded more like a folk song. It sounded like a jangly strummed, you know, acoustic guitar folk song with three-part harmonies. And it was Blair Cinta, the drummer, who just felt it as an R&B song. Mm. And his drum track that he sent back was not what I was expecting. I was expecting something with brushes or something, you know, kind of fluid and poetic. And he sends back this almost Otis Redding sharp smacked snare. And, you know, and that suddenly I'm like, oh, wait a minute, this is an R&B song. And then that led to me, you know, reaching into my network of collaborators and saying, does anyone know a great R&B singer? I feel like this is almost a gospel chorus. And that's when we found, I can't remember who introduced me to Maya Sykes, but then she appeared on every song on the album, just about singing harmonies. And it really, that one idea from one player, from our drummer, almost set a tone for the whole album, because it led to Maya, who has that sort of almost gospel, she's like a one woman gospel choir, so talented. And then I loved the way our voices interplayed and the way she kind of lifted the songs and the choruses. And so I used her on multiple tracks. So it kind of impacted almost the whole album, just that one drum track being heard differently than the way I heard it.
Yeah, and that's a great lesson for anyone in the audience who is an aspiring musician, that you might have a sound in your head and you're in love with it, of course, but it might be kind of a pedestrian kind of beat where you feel good about it and you're ready to go forward with it. All of a sudden, someone sends it back to you and has this groove to it that you could have never imagined. And you do have to avail yourself to the fact that maybe there actually is something that takes this song to the next level, that makes it sound even better than I already envisioned. And Eric just did a great job of describing that for us. Eric, on Sunday night, September 15th, you're going to be doing an album release show at the Hotel Cafe. What can people who attend expect to see that night? Meaning, will it just be you on stage, maybe you and one other musician, two other musicians, and then set list wise, every song on the new album, other original music too, cover songs? Tell us about what you've got planned for then.
So we have the full band that has appeared with me. First of all, they played with me when I was first releasing music from this album back in, I believe it was January. And most of them appeared on multiple tracks on the album. And it's a six-person band, incredible musicians, Michael Chavez on the guitar, Blair Cinta on the drums, Matt Rubano on the bass, Mai Bloomfield on the cello, and Maya Sykes on the backing vocals, and Neera Russell on the keyboard. So it's an incredible band of just great players. And if you've seen any of my music videos for the releases from this album, you've seen these players and you're already familiar with their performances. You know, I'm a big believer in chemistry, and these are all, you know, very hardworking session players who are touring with different bands and working all the time. But I wanted to wait for a time when I could get all of them together, because I just love the chemistry of this unit working together. So if you've been to the Hotel Cafe, you know, it's a very small stage. It'll be crowded up there, but it's going to be a raucous show. Every song on the album will be played. I have decided if I'm going to play it in the order of the album or mix it up. And of course, we're going to play a couple of other songs as well. There is a cover song that we're going to play that I've just been working out that's not on the album, but is kind of a dramatic reconsideration of the song 59th Street Bridge Song by Simon and Garfunkel, which is, you know, more colloquially known as Feeling Groovy. But I've kind of reconsidered that song. I think that's a folk song that wants to be a rock song. And I'm really looking forward to playing that live.
Very cool.
We've got a couple of other songs that are probably going to appear on the next album that are almost works in progress that we're workshopping, including another song that I'm collaborating with Aloe Black on again. So that song might make an appearance as well.
Here is that new segment I just added a couple weeks ago, the dates and locations for my 2024 NHTE tour, 10 years of talking tunes, as I go around the U.S. as part of the continued celebration for this show having hit back in February the milestone 10-year anniversary. This is a deliberate, proactive effort to meet you, the audience, in person to say thank you for being a major part in hitting a decade of Now Hear This Entertainment. September 23rd to the 28th, I will be in Los Angeles, including but not limited to speaking at the Outlier Podcast Festival. The next week, October 1st through the 6th, I will be in the Florida Panhandle at the Pensacola Beach Songwriters Festival, including but not limited to putting on a Promoting Your Music Career workshop on Saturday morning, October 5. There is no cost to attend that, by the way. It's free and open to the public. Friday night, October 11, I will be at the West Dawson Music Venue in Dawson Springs, Kentucky, for a show featuring three Nashville songwriters. At the beginning of December, I will be in Las Vegas speaking at the Las Vegas Writers Retreat, which, by the way, is for writers of books, not music. There is also a good chance of two other tour dates, two other cities being added. Sign up for the newsletter, keep listening to the show, follow on Instagram. I would love to meet you somewhere out on the road. Email me about meeting up or DM me through the @NowHearThisEntertainment Instagram account. Eric, let's go back to your early years. I read that you were born in Motown. Tell us about when and how you got your start in music, including at what age.
So, yes, I was born in Detroit and raised for the first, I don't know, two-thirds of my childhood. I think we moved when I was 12 or 13 years old. So my dad was a car designer. He worked for General Motors. He was a very creative, artistic guy, also a great musician. He was a classical clarinetist. He was actually a pop singer as well back in the day. And I think I caught the musical bug from him. And, you know, my parents at an early age made both my brother and I choose an instrument. I chose violin. I played violin pretty well for about 10 years. And then I decided I wanted to switch to something that was, you know, I wanted to play something in a musical genre that I could relate to. And I picked up the bass guitar. And I had an interesting relationship with music from the beginning because I struggled with learning disabilities and dyslexia. They don't call them learning disabilities anymore. They call them neurodivergencies or something like that. But that's what they called them back then. And so I couldn't read music. And my dad had a huge classical music collection. And I used to sneak into his vinyl record collection and find the piece that I was supposed to be learning. And I would learn it by ear. And I sort of outed myself inadvertently one day when I didn't turn the sheet music page at the right time for my teacher. And so then my teacher was looking at me like, what music are you reading right now? And then I think I burst into tears because I thought I was in trouble. But it actually led to a good conversation that led to me, you know, starting to deal with that and starting to get the help that I needed to slay that dragon, which I, you know, have done. I still read slowly. I still, you know, have some of the symptoms, but, you know, obviously I've overcome a lot of it. So, but when I picked up any other stringed instrument, the violin is so hard. It is the most kind of mechanically difficult instrument. There's no frets. It's, you know, really a difficult instrument to play. When I picked up a bass, it came supernatural to me. When I picked up a guitar, I was able to teach myself a lot of the basics of the guitar. And so I was pretty self-taught on the bass and the guitar for a long time. And when I got to California, my dad moved the family out here. As I said, when I was in about middle school, I think I went to middle school and high school down in San Diego. And I started my first band with my older brother when I was a freshman in high school. And he's a songwriter as well. He's also an author, writes fiction, a beautiful writer. And he actually makes an appearance on my album. He wrote the final song, which is called Goodnight Nobody. And it's a song that I love, and it fits really well thematically with the album. It's also a nice bookend. The first song is called Good Morning. The last song is called Good Night, Nobody. So that's the beginning and end of the album. And he and I were in our first band together, and we always wanted to write the songs. We always wanted to play originals. He was a few years ahead of me, so when he graduated, I created my own band, and I was hooked. And, you know, some version of that band stayed with me through all of high school, all of college, and well into my, you know, the early years of my professional career, probably more years than was advisable from a professional standpoint, but as my advertising career was taking over. But I kept playing and kept, you know, going to clubs and everything. But, you know, as I look back on it, I feel like for whatever reason, I'm someone who needed to live a lot of life to have something to say as a songwriter. Mm. And when I look back on it, I feel like I had, you know, I was a decent player and decent singer and was comfortable on stage and stuff. But if when I look back at it, I don't think I would have signed me to a record deal back then either, you know? Mm. So I think only later in life when I, you know, had a whole bunch of other experiences, did my songwriting sort of blossom into something else that I feel more proud of.
So am I hearing, did you reach a point where in your professional career you said, okay, I don't like it, but I really need to put the music to the side and just focus on my corporate career and not about writing and recording and releasing music and playing shows?
Sort of. Not all of those. I put aside performing and playing live and playing in a band. There was a certain point where just the demands of life, both professionally and otherwise, just became too overwhelming to keep that going. But the writing and recording really never diminished for me. Mm. I've been doing it at a pretty, I don't know what to compare it to, I only know myself, but at a pretty, you know, high velocity my whole life. And as I became more and more public as an executive, which gratefully I did, I became more and more private as an artist. And, you know, when I was running the ad agency, you mentioned that I was the CEO of Deutsch. I was the co-CEO with a partner, but I was also the chief creative officer. And so when I was the creative director of an ad agency, it sort of felt more, I don't know, quote unquote, on brand to have outside creative projects like songwriting and making music. So there's an album from back in 2004, an EP that I put out during my professional career. But when I became, you know, an officer at a public company like Activision, and you have an earnings call every 12 weeks, mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't think people are interested in hearing your love songs. So, yeah, it became very private. And in a weird way, that was hard because I had this really incredible moment where a person who I consider to be not just a work friend, but a really close friend who had known me for, I think, a decade, was in my house, and this is someone who I became friends with through working, and saw a guitar on a stand in the corner of my living room and said, oh, who in the family plays guitar? And I just, it was this moment where it's like the words came out of his mouth in slow motion, you know? Mm. And it was like, oh my God, how is this person who I considered myself, you know, very close with and very open with, not know? That's like the other half of my body over there.
Yeah.
That's the other half of my heart, you know? And so I realized, you know, you really are almost leading an emotional double life here. And it might've been all in my head, but I wasn't comfortable putting things out when I was the CEO of a division of a big, you know, public company. And so I didn't. And when I left and I stepped aside, the first thing I wanted to do was put out an album. And in a weird way, it's the first time I'm sort of being my whole self,
yeah,
in public since I was a young person.
Wow.
And so it's got a double joy for me. One is just the joy of putting out music and the gift of music and having that as part of my life. And the other is just kind of reharmonizing these different parts of myself.
Funny enough, the friend story that you just told, the first thing I could think of was somebody standing in stately Wayne Manor and looking at Bruce Wayne and just bad-mouthing Batman and saying, you know, the guy's useless and who would go around and do that kind of thing. It's like, man, that's me. That's my heart. That's me that's doing that. What do you mean who'd go around and do that thing? Like, that's my guitar. You don't even want me to bust that thing out right now. So, Eric, talk to us about your time at Activision. Did being in that environment, which was entertainment, just not of the recording artist variety, did that in any way play a part in the original music you would end up making, or not at all? And the two just had zero overlap. There's no takeaways from the environment there that bled over into the music you were creating.
Yeah, I think you learn a lot about your own creative process from working and seeing other people's creative processes. You know, Activision was an extraordinarily creative company, and the developers who make these games, you know, are extremely talented people. And so I learned a lot just by watching how they worked. And I have an art degree. I went to art school. I didn't go to business school. Obviously, I'm a very creatively oriented CEO, but I was still the CEO. I wasn't a hands-on-the-clay creative person making these games. There are some topics and some things that came from my work life that became songs. Like, I don't know if you heard the song Can't Find the Ocean on my last album, but in rock and roll terms, it scans like a touring song, almost like the exhaustion of the road, but it's really about work life. And I got a card in the mail from American Airlines that you know, congratulations, you crossed 7 million miles on one airline.
Whoa.
And it's sort of one of these dubious honor moments where you're like, is that a good thing? They're saying congratulations, but that sounds really hard. So that song is all about the toll of those miles and just, you know, the toll of that work life can take on all of us. But so topics, certainly. The place where I think I learned the most, you mentioned earlier about letting other creative people do their thing and being open to the input and the contribution of other artists as a part of your art. I really learned to do that at the ad agency, you know, because as I said, I was not only the CEO, I was also the chief creative officer. So I'm also, you know, responsible for making the creative product of that company. And that's a team sport. You've got writers, you've got art directors, you've got video editors, you've got film directors, you've got composers. A great Super Bowl spot is the creative process is identical to making a blockbuster movie. It's just, you know, 60 or 90 seconds long instead of, you know, 60 or 90 minutes long. So I really learned a lot about, we all have the sort of thing in our head. We all know how we think it should be. But lots of times you have a core idea that's a spark. And when it meets someone else's flint, the flame travels in a surprising direction. And so I really kind of learned the value of and the art of, you want to give input, you want to give direction, you want to an extent, tell people what you're going for, because I think everyone benefits from some parameters and some guardrails. But then you want to create an environment where people feel comfortable giving you their best work, giving you the thing that they think is going to make it magic.
That's
and sometimes you don't agree and it ends up on the cutting room floor, but lots of times you get one of those incredible surprises that just takes it in a new direction and you benefit from that openness.
I love it. I love it. Great stories, great lessons too. I am joined today on the Now Hear This Entertainment guest line from Los Angeles by singer, songwriter, guitar player Eric Hirschberg. Visit his official website at erichirschbergmusic.com. I will have a link to it on the show page for this episode on my podcast website, nhte.net. Once you land on his website, there are links there for his original music that will take you to very hearty Linktree type lists containing lots of different places to go get his first album and singles from his upcoming new album. You heard him talk about Secondhand Smoke, his 9-song album that comes out on September 13th. Pre-order that now from iTunes, and don't forget that if you are or will be in the Los Angeles area on September 15, he will be doing an album release show that night at the Hotel Cafe. Be sure to give Eric a follow on Spotify, although don't just stream. Support him by purchasing downloads of his original music. As you heard in the intro, big, big numbers on his YouTube channel. At the top of erichirschbergmusic.com, you will see links, logos for Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and Instagram so that you can follow him on one or more of those. This morning, I was live on the OWL app for 3 hours. If you listen to this podcast regularly, thank you, of course, but you might notice that I say that a lot. Typically, Monday mornings from approximately 9 a.m. to 12 noon Eastern time, I am live on there. But anytime you want to call me on there when I'm not live, you just tap the request to go live button. I will get notified and do so, and then you will get a notification that I did so that you can then call me. OWL, like the bird, except with 2 W's and 2 L's, is a social networking platform that connects people instantly through private one-on-one audio calls. Don't miss the word private in there. No one sees your phone number. The calls are done through the app. It is a great way to meet people who you can collaborate with regardless of the career you're in, and start that relationship quickly rather than waiting for a connection request to be accepted and or a private message to be returned. Here's a little hack. This also eliminates any concern about international calls. Wink, wink. On my podcast website, nhte.net, tap or click into the news section and then look for the article in there under the headline, Help Now a Phone App Call Away. The OWL app is free to download, and I have links in that article to get it from the App Store or Google Play. Plus, I have my invitation code in that article because you will need that as you're setting up the app on your phone. It is a required field. Eric, before we move on, I just want to continue the discussion a little bit about your days with Activision and or Deutsch LA, for that matter. You're saying that nobody there knew that you're a musician, if I'm understanding you correctly. So to that point, was it still kind of a, hey, we have a lot of fun type atmosphere and everyone's encouraged to kind of let their hair down a bit? Or was this like, Bruce, you know, as much as I would have loved for it to be like that, it was just long hours, daily grind. Like there was no room for trying to turn this into, you know, does anybody here play music?
First of all, I want to correct you. It's not that no one knew I played music. There were people, friends who I did share my music with. I was just surprised that someone who I was as close with as I was with this one person didn't know that. So it just felt like a moment where I'm like, wow, you're really hiding this from the world. But no, there were definitely people who knew I played music. In terms of answering your question, it was a bit of both. There was definitely, you know, the creative process in any environment, even in a big publicly traded corporation like Activision, the creative process is fun. The creative process is experimentation. The creative process is collaboration. It's spontaneous. There's laughter. There's, you know, debate. That's my favorite part of business. It always has been. And at the same time, that's a big company. They're a publicly traded company. They've got an earnings call every 12 weeks. They were a very disciplined company, very financially smart company. So I had to, when I went there, as I said, I came from art school and a creative industry like advertising. I didn't come from business school and a typical executive background. I had to learn a lot of new skills to up my game as an executive that understood the technology, that understood the finances, that understood the global commercialization elements. Now, I find that really fun. I like learning new things. One of the best things about that experience for me was just in the middle of, you know, I think I was 20 plus years into my career, to just climb a whole new learning curve was really a thrill for me. And it was scary. I can tell this story now because you know, it was a successful run and, you know, the book is closed. And but when I took the job, I gave Deutsch, I think, 2 months notice because, you know, I'd been there for 14 years and my partner and I had opened Deutsch LA. So, I, you know, it was a big moment, me leaving the company, and I wanted to give them plenty of runway. But in that couple month period between when I'd accepted the job and when I bought the job, you know, those yellow and black books for dummies?
Yeah.
It's, you know, I bought Reading Financial Reports for Dummies because I, you know, I didn't want to walk in and not know any of the acronyms and not know what anything meant. And I read it and I made my wife read it and we took notes and, you know, I had her quiz me on it because I wanted to walk in on my first day and not, you know, I knew that if I was just the creative CEO, I feared that I would be, you know, easy to dismiss.
Yeah.
Because creative people sometimes, as they should, we tend to make our arguments from a place of passion, and businesses run wherever they can from a place of logic and predictability and, you know, a good sound, you know, research whenever you can. So I wanted to be able to speak both languages. And I think the experience of being there for me really gave me that new set of muscles.
Wow.
But no, there was definitely, you know, the process of creating the games, creative, fun, also a grind, you know, it's incredibly complex software. It's not all fun and games, but there is a joy to the creative process, I find, no matter where it's taking place.
Yeah, just don't expect to walk by Eric's office at that time and see him noodling on the guitars is the moral of the story.
For sure. That was later that night at home.
Grammy nominee Liz Phair, who charted on the Billboard Hot 100, is said to be a fan of your work and compared your style to Bruce Springsteen. Have the two of you actually met? How did you get on her radar? And by the way, how do you feel about her comparing you to The Boss?
Okay, so yes, we've met. We are close friends. She was dear enough to give me that quote a few years ago. And she was an early, I don't know what to call it. She was an early supporter of mine, but also an early, very honest broker and critic of mine. So, you know, I think the value that I've gotten from Liz is not, I love that quote. I love Bruce Springsteen's one of my favorite artists. So I love that she chose that comparison. But the real value of me getting lucky enough to become friends with Liz is that she's always been honest with me and told me when something stinks or when something's not there yet or when I need to dig deeper or when I'm not being honest enough or open enough or making myself vulnerable enough or when something's not quite there. She's, you know, an incredibly honest and valuable sounding board, or at least has been at certain times. So I'm a huge admirer of hers. You know, I was a fan before I was a friend. My wife was in the art gallery business. She owned an art gallery, and Liz just happened to come into one of my wife Tara's openings with a friend of hers. And I walked up to her and told her I was a fan and struck up a conversation, and we became friends, and we've been friends ever since.
Nice.
And if you go deep into the Spotify search, you'll find a song called Bend from that EP that I released in 2004, and Liz actually was nice enough to sing harmony on it.
Ah, very nice. Very nice. And I sense a blog coming on, because that was a great lesson that you just gave out, Eric, that it is really important to not surround yourself with someone who is going to give you that kind of feedback and tell you when something that is near and dear to your heart as it is, you probably are a little close to, and you need an uninterested third party or an interested third party to say, look, when you've got the resume that I do, in the case of Liz, this may not be what you want it to be, and you know, maybe have another go at it.
Well, first of all, it helps if the person giving you their honest feedback is also one of the greatest, you know, songwriters.
Exactly.
And all the accolades she's won in her career, you know, it helps if they've actually got the chops. But yes, I'm a big believer in that the worst thing for creative ideas is a bunch of people who agree.
Yep.
Things really get electric when you find people who have a dissenting opinion. And when I can't find one, I go looking for it.
Mm.
You know, when everyone likes something, I feel like something's wrong. My spider sense goes, something's wrong with this.
Wow.
It's too vanilla or too, you know, anodyne.
Wow.
Liz was over at a dinner party. This is way back when she first found out I was a writer. And, you know, I think Tara said it. And I was almost like, of course, I wanted to play it for her, but it almost felt like embarrassed. Or sheepish. And she came down, we broke away, and she came down to my music studio, which is in you know, the basement of our house. And it was sort of like, I could tell that was simultaneously like, you know, that sigh of relief when someone plays you their stuff and, you know, I have to assume she thought it was going to suck. And there's a little bit of like, okay, he's not tone deaf. There's something here. So there was both a little bit of encouragement and also a little bit of like, what do you mean by this lyric?
Mm.
Well, that's not what that lyric says to me.
Mm.
Or what are you trying to say with this? Do you know what you're trying to say with this? It sounds like you're in the zip code of an idea, but you haven't found the address yet. She was really like piercing right away. So I just got so much out of that lucky chance meeting.
Yeah. How can you not embrace that? And it goes to a point that I have made for years and years. If you are someone who has, I always like to say, a high school age child, that child, if they're showing promise, if he or she really looks like music might be in their future, you need to get them to where they are going to get a qualified opinion. Because if they enter a contest at their high school and it's just sponsors who are all going to sit there and say nothing but nice things to every contestant, that doesn't help.
They're not going to grow. No, that's not where the growth lies. I call it the gift of the truth. And, you know, with music, with all forms of art, it's so personal. I think it's so uncomfortable for people to be honest. Everyone wants to be nice. And then the real feedback happens on the car ride home when you're not there. And so there's a talent that you develop after many years in corporate life of teasing the truth out of people. I used to call it the hallway meeting. The hallway meeting right before the meeting and right after the meeting. Mm. That's when people are being honest. But when they're sitting at the boardroom table, oftentimes everyone falls in line with what they think the boss wants to hear, or what they think the company line is. And then they go out and they're like, why are we doing this? I don't get it. Do you get it?
Wow.
And you know, when I sensed that was going on, I'm like, we want to have the debate. Let's have it out. And you really have to convince people that you're serious. You have to convince people that that's something you want. And I actually wrote a book of values at Activision that sort of tried to capture and inspire reflected the values that were there and also that I wanted to bring to the place. And one of them was seek opposing points of view.
I love it. I love it.
Because there's nothing worse for the creative process than a bunch of people sitting around a table who all think it's awesome.
Yeah. And you also have to keep in mind the youngsters that, of course, your mom and dad are going to tell you how great you are, and they should, but that's why it's so important. And you find yourself in the company of someone like Liz Phair, you write down and you digest everything that they're telling you, because they have no skin in the game and they're not going to waste your time and theirs telling you what they think you want to hear. While we're talking about her, speaking of notable names in music, I mentioned back in the intro about a song that you did, Eric, with Dave Koz, who is someone I've always been a big fan of. How did you get him to be a part of that track?
So another happy accident of life, I became good friends with Norman Lear, who recently passed away, and who I think we were at a, it was some kind of fundraiser for an art museum. I think it might've been the LA County Museum of Art that we were both supporting. And I saw him and I, you know, admired him. And I walked up to him. The first thing I said to him was, "Hey, I just want to thank you for raising me." And he said, yeah, he didn't miss a beat. He said, "Well, if I raise you, I should probably get to know you. Have a seat." And so, you know, I sat down and again, I was lucky enough for, you know, that chance meeting became a friendship and became a very close friendship over time. And the reason I bring him up is because he's the one who I met Dave Koz through. There was one night where Norman said he invited me to a dinner party, and almost as a throwaway at the end of the phone call, I said, "Oh, and bring your guitar." Mm. And I thought, that's a weird request for a dinner party. But okay, he said it, I brought it. And what I found out once I got there is that Norman kind of curated these almost like salon-like dinners of, you know, different people in his life. Mm. And this was all the musicians in his life, all the people who played music in his life.
Wow.
And it was an incredible group. And Dave Koz was there, John Burke and Glenn Barros, the founders of Concord Records that Norman had some early involvement with, was there. The comedian Bob Saget was there. Mm. He's also passed away. Yeah. So, you know, high mortality rate in this group of friends, unfortunately. But Dave Koz was there. Rick Braun, the great trumpet player, who's also a frequent collaborator of Dave's, was there. Rick played on a song on my last album called 50 Cent Piece. He played the trumpet. There's a beautiful muted trumpet solo at the end that Rick played. But there's a video that you can see on my Instagram. I'll send you the link when we're done. That I had a friend of mine who's a photographer and a cameraman. Sometimes I had him come over when I had other musicians in the room just to capture a little bit of the process. And we were playing the song Good Morning, and we ended a take. And I said something like, you know, the end just feels like it's crying out for some kind of a solo. Mm. And we started brainstorming, what is it? Is it a honky-tonk piano solo? Is it a guitar solo? And Matt Rubano, the brilliant bass player, said saxophone. And I was like, that would be great. And we started saying, like, who do you know, you know, who could play it? And I said, you know, I'm good friends with this guy, Dave Koz, thinking they might not have heard of him because he's in such a different genre. And he literally goes like, you know Dave Koz? Like, why are we still talking about this? Call your friend Dave Koz. You know? And so I called Dave, and, you know, he's always touring. He's got his own, you know, people go on cruises to just hear him play. And so he was hard to schedule, but he was so sweet, and he wanted to do it. And so I found we literally had an hour with him in Hollywood at a studio, and he came in, and I made sure that the same friend who films all of my videos, his name's Josh Rose, brilliant photographer and cinematographer, and he was there, the band was there, Dave came in, gave us three takes, and it was like, you can just hear us hooting afterwards, like, it was just so perfect, so awesome. And I could literally have used any of the three unedited and just put it on the song. It would have been amazing.
I'm sure. Outstanding.
And he liked it too, because it ended and he goes, you know, I don't usually get to play a lot of rock and roll like this. This is great. This feels like a different muscle for me.
Nice.
But, you know, those jazz musicians, my God, just the level of mastery that he has over that instrument. It's just beautiful.
That's why people go on cruises and why he's always booked. Does being the former CEO and chief creative officer at a leading advertising agency and having been inducted into the American Advertising Federation's Hall of Achievement make it much easier when it comes to promoting your music? Or do you feel that you actually are in the same boat with all the indie musicians who are trying to get noticed?
God, you would think it would.
Yeah.
First, I think there's two things. One is I feel like I can market anything in the world except maybe this. You know, I think that it can't help but be over some line of too personal, too close. Mm. You know, it's hard to decenter. And what the great value that an ad agency brings to a company when they're going to launch a product is it gives you that fresh set of eyes. And lots of times, particularly in engineering-led cultures, I found that the thing that the client or that the company thought was special was not the thing that I thought the consumer was going to find special.
Wow.
Because they were in love with some technical milestone or some technical innovation that was really hard to achieve, that was an elegant solution. And you're like, okay, that's going to be a great benefit once they're using it. But I actually think we need to, you know, that fresh set of eyes is really helpful. And I have found it kind of like nearly impossible to provide that for myself, for my own creations.
Yeah.
So just like I do with musicians, I surround myself with smart people who I think will tell me the truth. Josh Rose is one of them. Josh was a team member, team leader at Deutsch when I was there. He was the head of the digital, we used to call it digital back when digital was a novelty, you know, when the internet and social media and all these things were coming online, ad agencies had to adapt. And he was the sort of digital creative director, and he was also a brilliant photographer, which was kind of his equivalent of the music in the background of his life.
Yeah.
He's now transitioned where he's, you know, working full time as a photographer and a filmmaker. But I surround myself with people like him. I always ask people for their honest opinion, and I try my best to find a way to present the music in a way that feels, you know, true to the music, but also something that's going to reach a large audience. And I think from time to time it's worked. You know, I had this song, I don't know if you've heard it, but it was on my last album called I Want America Back, which was released right before the last election. And it was a sort of anti-Trump protest song. And that video got over 1 million views. Mm. And I think a big part of that was the visual. I just came up with this idea of animating the lyrics onto protest signs.
Mm.
And that, you know, that was at that time when the whole world just seemed like it was protesting. And there were people in the streets on several different, you know, there was Black Lives Matter and there was the Women's March and there was, you know, there was all kinds of movements that were sort of coalescing at that time. And so Josh and I had been to some of these protests just as participants, and Josh had taken some beautiful photographs and I had a few photographs too. But when you look at that video, the lyrics just animated onto the protest signs that people were holding. And I think, you know, I'd like to think it was all the song. I think it's a good song. And I think, you know, it was released at the right time. I released it like 3 or 4 months before the election when people were really starting to focus on it. And so I think it was good content that was topical, but I attribute a healthy percentage of that thing sort of catching fire to the fact that we found a good visual for it.
Yeah, there's a lot of artists who say, when I wrote the song, I already saw the music video for it. But there's a whole bunch that don't see it that way. And I got to believe that your background in advertising does make you visualize that a lot faster and come up with that music video idea. But I totally get what you're saying about being too close to it to say. You would think I would be the best promoter of my own music, and you just can't get across that finish line because you are so close to it. And it's obviously very different from working for a client. So I see what
you're
saying.
But it's interesting. It cuts both ways. In that one, I feel like it played to my favor. There's another song on my last album called What You Get, which is about dyslexia. And that is one where when I was writing the lyrics, I saw the lyrics animating in a very particular way where they started scrambled.
Mm.
And so they would come up as nonsense sentences, and then the letters would rearrange themselves into the lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
And that was sort of a visual expression to me of what it felt like to, you know, lead life with dyslexia. And that's my least favorite music video of anything I've ever done.
Wow.
Because it's a cool concept, but it ended up, I don't know, it feels like it almost looks like an ad. It almost looks too too slick and too conceptual. And so, you know, this album, I really took a different approach where I really just wanted to put people in the room with me and the other musicians and just have it be very intimate and personal. And so it's just sort of well-captured performance videos. But if you notice, if you watch the videos, we're all facing each other. We're not facing an audience. We're not performing on a stage. We're in a studio environment working and collaborating. And that was real. You know, we were there for multiple days, and Josh and a couple of other camera people that he brought captured that process. And, you know, hopefully that intimacy comes across. But that's obviously a much lighter conceptual idea.
Sure.
And I think sometimes that's where my tendency through advertising is to come up with an arresting, clever, creative concept. And I don't think that's always what works in music videos. I think sometimes just getting people close to the emotion and close to the feeling and close to the process is what works.
Yeah, that and the idea of less is more, that someone who excels at cinematography is going to bring to you. And again, it gets back to that same recurring theme of that's why they're there. That's what they do best. We're going to close today with another one of Eric's original songs, one called The Most Beautiful Boy. Eric, before I let you go and I play that track, share with the audience first all about this one, if you would, please.
So I wrote this song a long time ago. It kind of was one on a pile that I felt like belonged on an album one day. And it was a song I wrote when I became a father. And I have two sons. I wrote another song about my second son being born, which actually came out first. It was on my last album. It's, you know, it's not about my son. It is, of course, but it's also more about fatherhood and just about what the emotional, I don't know what to call it, expansion of your emotional heart that brought to my life. And yeah, it's really just about the transformation of going from not having kids to having kids and what that meant to me. And for the music video on this one, we were just talking about music videos. This one is one of the more viewed videos on my Instagram reels. My son, who's grown up to be a terrific guitar player in his own right, played it with me and sang it with me. And I sort of, you know, used that as the through line and then just a photo slideshow of, you know, life between a father and a son. So it's a pretty straightforward song. A lot of people have written songs about becoming parents, and this is my contribution to that.
Still, though, I'm standing here with this huge grin on my face. I just think that's so great. It must have been just an absolute highlight for you to do that with him, and a great memory that you're going to remember the song notwithstanding.
Yeah, absolutely. And we actually filmed it on his 20th birthday, which was an extra. It was a fun way to spend his birthday together.
Too cool. Too cool. Eric, congratulations on the new album. Great to talk to you. Thank you so much for making time to be on Now Hear This Entertainment. This was great.
It was my pleasure, Bruce. Thank you.
Folks, with that, I will wrap up another new episode of Now Hear This Entertainment. My sincere thanks to singer, songwriter, guitar player Eric Hirschberg. Do visit his official website at erichirschbergmusic.com. As I mentioned before, I will have a link to it on the show page for this episode on my podcast website, nhte.net. His new album, Secondhand Smoke, comes out next week, Friday. That is September 13th. Get on iTunes and pre-save it. If you are or will be in the Los Angeles area on September 15th, make plans to be at his album release show at the Hotel Cafe. On his website, look for the music option in the navigation menu so you can access Linktree-type lists for his first album as well as the singles he has been releasing this year. There's a whole bunch of platforms there that you can link over to. One of those, of course, is Spotify. Be sure to hit the follow button when you're on there. This morning, I followed Eric on Facebook, X, and Instagram, and I'm sure he would appreciate you doing the same. Make sure to not only check out, but subscribe to his YouTube channel. You've been hearing him talking about videos, and I mentioned earlier that it has a combined total of more than 2.5 million video views. For that matter, tell Eric you heard him and his music. I Now Hear This Entertainment. I do truly hope that you like this show, that you're enjoying what I'm doing every week on the Now Hear This Entertainment podcast. If you have made it all the way to the end, thank you for having stuck with Eric and I, and I'm going to assume that that means that you do like the podcast. You can take action to let me know that you appreciate the work that I do to keep making this show happen every week, every month, 10 and a half years without missing once, by going on my podcast website, nhte.net, and then using the yellow Buy Me a Coffee logo that you will see there. This is not a sponsor. It's not affiliated with any brand or chain. It's just a fun way for you to send your support, your thanks to me, including a note that I will see when you utilize that option. You can also just head directly to buymeacoffee.com/BruceW. That's going to do it for episode 551. Thanks ever so much for listening. I'll send you out today with another song from Eric Hirschberg. This is the one he just talked about. It's called The Most Beautiful Boy.
I can't believe that something as beautiful as you had anything to do with me. And I don't know where you got those eyes. I can't believe quickly everything changed and how much that's okay with me. I never knew love could be so wide. I must be lucky, 'cause I'm not this good. Look around, want you, and I'll be there. Whenever the world seems like it's so unfair, I'll be there to make sure you're not alone. 'Cause you're the most beautiful boy the world has ever known. Them away from you for as long as I can, so you can sleep like someone who's never been afraid to die. Hope, love, and grace, it's all that I see when I get home and look at the smile on your face. You know that I'll never tell you a lie. I must be lucky, 'cause I'm not this wise. Look around you, and I'll be there. Whenever the world seems like it's so unfair, I'll be there to make sure you're not alone. 'Cause you're the most beautiful boy world has ever known. Colored blocks in the bathtub, colored letters in the hall, colored balls on the staircase, colored scribbles on the wall, colored sounds in your laughter, colored sparkles in your eyes. Ever since you got here for the first time in my life, the last thing I see when I drift off to sleep is a smile.